It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, as we do darn near every week, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning, and hey, for those of you listening to the terrestrial signal here in Seattle, we are actually back on the air.
We're back. We got the transmitter back up. So, let's start out with local. We got a big, long list here to cover.
Yeah.
Tim Iman.
Tim Iman is a liar. He made this great big to-do when he handed in his signatures for his latest $30 car tab initiative, I-917, that he had over 300,000 signatures, way more than the 224, I think it is, 1,000 that are needed to qualify for the ballot in November. And funny thing, he's not going to make it. He was off by a factor of at least 30%. Now, how did that happen? Well, probably Iman was lying. It turned out that a number of his petitions were filed improperly. Maybe he's been taking lately to showing up for press events in the costumes of fictional characters, the Buzz Lightyear and King Kong and God knows what else. Darth Vader. Maybe he's just gotten too fond of fiction. But Iman has really actually had a very bad record of initiatives, especially lately. He's gotten a lot more media and credibility than probably he deserves. Let's bear that in mind the next time he comes up with some half-assed, initiative next year. He's really losing his credibility, and he's lost a lot of his organization. And he has one sort of sugar daddy that backs a lot of his initiatives. And when that disappears, Tim Iman disappears also.
All right. Well, moving along to national, Alaska, for different reasons, is featuring prominently in this.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on from Alaska politics this last week or two. How about that? Ted Stevens, who up until very recently was one of the most powerful senators in the Senate, but he's been having a bad, bad summer. First of all, it was finally revealed a couple of weeks ago that he was the mysterious senator who put a hold on put an anonymous hold on a widely supported bipartisan measure to create a government database for essentially earmarks, appropriations by Congress, by individual members, of which Stevens is one of the leading practitioners. Now, apparently Robert Byrd of West Virginia, the octogenarian Democrat, also tried to put a hold on it, and he does a lot of earmarks as well. But Stevens has certainly gotten a lot of the negative publicity for that. And then there was a FBI raid on the offices of six different members of the Alaska state legislature, including the president of the state Senate, a guy named Ben Stevens, who, coincidentally enough, happens to be Ted Stevens' son. It's an oil field pipeline services company called VECO, V-E-C-O, and VECO turns out to have also paid Ben Stevens $243,000 in the 5 years before he was elected to the Alaska State Legislature. Why? Well, nobody's really that clear, except, of course, that he was Ted Stevens' son. Also, very interestingly, VECO is the second largest contributor to Ted Stevens' campaigns over his career in the in Congress. Interestingly enough, this year, with Stevens not running for re-election, he has two more years in his term, and then he has said he will retire. With Stevens not running for re-election, VECO is putting money into one and only one congressional campaign this year, and that Senate campaign, excuse me, and that campaign is for Mike T.M. McGavick. He returned this week $14,000 from VECO because of the unsavory association with Stevens, who has been a major patron of his ever since Stevens declared war on Maria Cantwell for her having stopped ANWR drilling last December. VECO has also put $25,000 into a Republican National Fund earmarked for Senate campaigns, and you can bet your bottom dollar that that money is being funneled back into McGavick's campaign. He has not returned any of that money. He also hasn't returned money from VECO executives. It totals about $50,000, and McGavick still has $36,000 of that. So he's got some more explaining to do above and beyond his DUI inconsistencies and some of the other problems he's had lately. Oh, and one other development in Alaska this week. I talked a few weeks ago about BLM land, the Department of the Interior, trying to do oil drilling rights in a sensitive wetland area on the North Slope called Lake Teshikpuk. Teshikpuk Lake, excuse me. It's near the National Petroleum Reserve, west of where Anwar is, but it's the largest freshwater lake on the North Slope, and it's that and the wetlands between there and the Arctic Ocean, which is getting even wetter as the permafrost melts. It's an extremely sensitive area environmentally. BLM wanted to drill without really doing any kind of environmental review at all. U.S. District Judge in Anchorage threw it out. He put a hold on it, and all observers think that it's going to that lawsuit is going to win. They're going to be unable to do drilling in that area. So that's good news. And again, that is something that Stevens has pushed hard for.
All right. Well, yesterday the Senate came out with a new report.
Yeah, it's funny how bad news in the Republican-controlled Washington, D.C. always comes out very late on a Friday afternoon. Happened again yesterday with the Senate Foreign Relations, no, it's the Intelligence Committee, I'm sorry, that came out with a report that verified everything that Democratic critics of the run-up to the war in Iraq have been saying for 4 years, and then some. Among other things, it says that the White House knew from multiple sources in the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, a claim that President Bush has been making as recently as August 21st of this year, that is 2 weeks ago, when he was claiming that al-Qaeda, or rather that Saddam and Zarqawi had a relationship. The report specifically states that Saddam not only didn't have a relationship with Zarqawi, but was actively trying to apprehend him. It also mentioned that the Iraqi National Congress, the exile group that Ahmed Shalabi ran, was defunded by the White House in 2002 after the CIA and the DIA had said that not only was the INC unreliable for the intelligence that it was giving, but that it had been penetrated by Iranian intelligence, which we knew later, found out later, was in the form of Chalabi himself, among others. But the White House continued to cite INC information that it knew was false all the way to the run-up to the war, including during Colin Powell's February 2003 UN speech. And the list just goes on and on. It really is a very clear laying out of some of the explicit lies that the Bush administration was using to sell the war, and there really is no doubt right now that they were intentional and they were lies. And you know, things like this were things that were being said on this program and many other analysts at the time in 2002 and 2003. It simply wasn't credible to anybody who knew anything about the Middle East that Saddam Hussein, a secular moderate Sunni, had any kind of interest or relationship with al-Qaeda, which is, you know, a fundamentalist Shiite. Similarly, again, that the Iraqi National Congress was providing, accurate information when they were so clearly self-interested in trying to seize power in Iraq, and the neocon establishment pushing for war in Washington, D.C. was very interested in putting them into power in Iraq. So a very damning report, made even more damning by the fact that it was released by a Republican-controlled committee. And the White House, of course, is saying, oh, this is all old news, there's nothing new here. But if it were all old news and insignificant, they wouldn't have released it very late on a Friday afternoon. So that tells you that they know also that this is pretty damaging stuff.
Yeah, and the Iraqi National Congress was, in fact, originally funded by the U.S. So,
yes.
I mean,
it's
our creation. So, all right. Well, the fifth anniversary of 9/11 is coming up on Monday, and of course, that gives a lot of people in power a chance to create speeches around that.
Yes, and we've been seeing them for a couple weeks now. A very concerted Republican effort, probably orchestrated by Karl Rove, who incidentally is coming to town next week. We'll talk about that under events, and hopefully, somebody's organizing a protest. There's a very specific Republican campaign underway. We're going to be hearing it all the way from now to November 7th, basically to tar anybody who criticizes Bush foreign policy in the war in Iraq as, you know, essentially on al-Qaeda's side, invoking World War II a lot, since that was the last war that the United States was involved in 60-plus years ago that actually made any kind of sense from a moral standpoint. And, you know, in a lot of different ways, being disingenuous about what's going on the field in places, on the ground in places like Iraq. So we had in particular a significant speech by President Bush on Tuesday, on September 5th, that greatly expanded the war on terror rhetorically, which is, you know, a hard thing to do when they've already been calling it a 100 years war. But Bush has been conflating for some time now all sorts of different Muslim opposition to American foreign policy. They're all terrorists. They're all working together. And Bush went one step further on Tuesday. This is the same speech in which he started talking about the prisoners that were being transferred to Guantanamo Bay, acknowledging the CIA had secret prisons, etc., and defending all of that as being vital to U.S. national security interests and, you know, a great part of the war on terror, and everybody should be thankful, etc. But he was basically saying, look, what al-Qaeda wants to do is to set up a fundamental Muslim state that extends all the way from Morocco to Indonesia. He actually said this in pretty much those words, which is, you know, utterly preposterous. Now, and, you know, even if that were one of their goals, it certainly wasn't their goal to think of anything that ambitious until Bush's foreign policy made it possible by giving fundamentalist groups like al-Qaeda, and remember, it's not just al-Qaeda that you know, has this kind of analysis or attitude toward the United States. There are all sorts of groups out there that do. But they didn't have any traction amongst the Muslim public after 9/11. In fact, there's also evidence that that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when bin Laden was holed up at Tora Bora, you know, he was apologizing to his followers for having made a tactical mistake in launching 9/11 because so much of the Muslim world was sympathetic to the United States. Well, W took care of that, much to bin Laden's delight, and 5 years later, you know, bin Laden is still on the loose, and of course, so is Mullah Omar and the Taliban in Afghanistan. We'll get to that. In the meantime, we have a rhetorical device in which Bush has essentially conflated everybody from you know, Hamas, the Hezbollah, the Iranians, Al Qaeda, you know, separatist groups in Indonesia, you know, all, you know, Kashmir. There are all of these different struggles that all have their specific local histories. A lot of different groups that really either have nothing to do with one another or hostile to one another. He's lumping them all together because they're all alarmed by U.S. foreign policy. And he's basically setting up for something some of his conservative followers are explicitly calling for, which is World War III. They're actually using that term now. This is World War III. And, you know, it goes along with the campaign to call them Islamo-fascists. Of course, the use of fascist ties in with the references to World War II, etc. So, very, very worrisome escalation in the rhetoric from Washington, D.C. And, of course, we also had some moves diplomatically this week that pushed us a step closer to a diplomatic and possibly military confrontation with Iran. That's very much still on the table. So, you know, not only are Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Rice and the rest of them all still lying about what's going on in the war on terror and claiming that it's a great success and that it was justified and that, you know, al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were linked and conflating 9/11 and the war in Iraq, which is still happening, even though, again, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report, as with the 9/11 Commission before it, explicitly states there was no relationship. Dramatic escalation and rhetoric, all about fear, all about the election. This whole campaign is about the election. But you can bet that people in the Muslim world are looking at this and rubbing their chin and saying, oh my God, they really are declaring war on the Muslim religion. It's very, very frightening, the rhetoric coming out of Washington right now.
All right. Well, speaking of frightening, the Department of Education is being very cooperative with other departments in the government.
Yes. Not very much noticed revelation that has come out that the Department of Education has been sharing information on student financial aid applications for the last 5 years, post 9/11, with the FBI. Now, bear in mind that to be eligible for student financial aid from the federal government, you almost always have to be a U.S. citizen. So basically what they're doing is they're taking information like, income from parents, work history, all the different little personal things that go into a financial aid application, and sharing that with the FBI. Again, creating a database. And you have to remember, this is from an administration that not only has been very secretive, but that has been very explicit going back to Poindexter's program on trying to collect all pieces of information available on every U.S. citizen. And we're seeing those walls knocked down all over the place, and the Department of Education revelation is one more piece in that.
All right. Also this week, it looks like things are getting a little tougher for whistleblowers.
Yeah. The Invaluable Group, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, has a report out this week that Attorney General Gonzalez has ruled that EPA whistleblowers, that is Environmental Protection Agency, who's been some of the people who work there have been up in arms really for the last 6 years over the Bush administration's refusal to enforce environmental law, making cozy with corporate violators, et cetera. He has ruled that EPA whistleblowers are no longer protected under federal law and the Clean Water Act and could be subject to prosecution. So very much a setback again for open government and the ability of the Bush administration to not enforce the law when the lawbreakers are people who contribute to their campaigns.
All right. And John Bolton, U.S. Representative to the United Nations.
Yeah, when I was in D.C. this week, I actually had talked with a lobbyist friend of mine who's working on trying to stop the Bolton nomination. You'll recall that he was a recess appointment to be the ambassador to the U.N. last year after the Senate actually refused to confirm him. Well, the recess appointment only lasts 1 year, so he still has to be confirmed. That fight is now going on in the Senate. It is holed up in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee right now. And according to my friend, that's the only place that it can be stopped, because the Republicans have votes on the floor of the House, not only from Republicans, but from a handful of Democrats as well this time, to confirm Bolton. Amazingly enough, we could stop him last year on the floor of the House or Senate, but we can't do it this year. So they were expecting that it would be confirmed this week in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but it wasn't. The vote has been postponed because a moderate Republican from Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee, who's up for re-election this year, in a tough fight, expressed to the Republican leadership that he had doubts about Bolton, so they have pulled that vote for now. But it's a very good time, again, to start leaning on not only Republicans, but also those holdout Democrats to try and oppose the Bolton nomination and get him stopped after all. Incidentally, one of the Democrats that's supporting or saying he'll vote yes for Bolton is Russ Feingold, oddly enough, who says, and this is again from my friend who's met personally with him, that Feingold can't stand Bolton, but he believes that the president should be able to name his own team, and that trumps how he feels personally about Bolton. So, that's the sort of deference to very, very bad appointments that has marked a lot of the Democratic refusal to stop some really bad people from having power in Washington the last 6 years.
All right. Well, for people that are considering a career in journalism, it looks like Florida might be a place to go get a job.
Yeah, although if you speak Spanish, it will help a lot. Miami Herald yesterday had a very interesting report. You remember people like Armstrong Williams being paid by the Department of Education, et cetera. Well, this is much bigger. 10 different journalists in Florida have been named by the Miami Herald, including, incidentally, three who were until this came out and they fired them, who were employed by the Herald itself or its sister Spanish publication. 10 different journalists who are being paid by the U.S. government to put out anti-Castro propaganda in their news stories. They are paid anywhere from $1,500 to $175,000 since 2001, rather, being paid through the U.S. Office of Cuba Broadcasting, which runs Radio Martí and TV Martí, which the Cuban government has long accused of basically being anti-Castro propaganda, and they've also accused different journalists in southern Florida of being on the U.S. government payroll, and guess what? They were right. Also, along with that, the Herald reports that there were no known instances of any of those journalists revealing that they had been paid by the U.S. government to write their reports. So yet another instance of the Bush administration propagandizing the American people and using taxpayer money to do it and paying journalists out of taxpayer money to do it. Extremely unethical, probably illegal.
All right. An update on Divine Strike.
Yeah, if you remember that was the test that was supposed to happen in Nevada last June that was a mock-up of dropping a mini nuke on Iran. What they wanted to do was run a simulated test to see how far such a strike could penetrate underground. Basically, they wanted to calibrate how large a nuclear bomb they needed in order to reach Iran's underground nuclear facilities. Well, that test was postponed indefinitely in Nevada due to a lawsuit from the Winnemucca Indian tribe and other plaintiffs that would have been downwind from the test. So, quietly, the Bush administration tried to move the test to a quarry in southern Indiana. Well, apparently, it has been stopped there also due to local opposition. So the Divine Strike still very much on the plate, as is a possible nuclear strike on Iran, but they can't find a place to run the test because nobody wants to be anywhere near it.
All right, and quickly, Abramoff update?
Yeah, a report that the FBI is questioning people with the Alexander Strategy Group, a group funded by former staff people of Tom DeLay, and several have pleaded guilty. Well, apparently Christine DeLay, the wife of Tom, and I've talked about that on this program before, she got $115,000 for a job that entailed determining the favorite charities of each member of Congress. Now the FBI is investigating whether that was a job at all, whether DeLay, Christine actually did any of that work, or it was simply a payment to Tom DeLay.
All right, before we jump to international, just got a quick email from a listener saying Al-Qaeda is Sunni, not Shia. The conservative Wahhabi tendency promoted
by right.
The
he's right. He's right. I'm sorry.
Opposes Shiaism as heresy.
I misstated that. However, between that and Saddam, there was still the very much secular versus fundamentalist gulf. They really did despise each other. But the listener's absolutely correct. Sorry about that.
Speaking of Saddam, let's
I'm a little sleep-deprived from the travel.
Let's start with Iraq.
Yeah, several things going on in Iraq this week. U.S. government and military was trumpeting the reports from the Baghdad morgue that in August only 550 people died, way down from the previous month. That was said to be evidence that the U.S. deployment of additional troops in Baghdad was a phenomenal success and a cut down on sectarian and violence, even though the day-to-day headlines didn't indicate that at all. Well, oddly enough, after those headlines came and went, we had the revelation that the Baghdad morgue had revised its estimate up to 1,536 dead in August from violent deaths in the Baghdad area, nearly triple what it originally was reported to be. No explanation forthcoming from the health ministry or the Baghdad morgue as to why the discrepancy by a factor of three. The Iraqi parliament came back into session this week for the first time in a long while, and we had the Sunni speaker of the parliament warning that only 3 or 4 months was left before Iraq, the Iraqi army had to take control of Iraq within 3 or 4 months or face a total collapse of the country. Toward that end, the parliamentary party that has control of the parliament, a Shiite fundamentalist party, is pushing a bill that would codify the procedure by which Iraq could be split into three separate autonomous regions. Now, remember that this was something that was encoded in the original constitution that was voted on and passed under questionable conditions over a year ago. Sunnis were lined up overwhelmingly against that constitution, and one of their major gripes was this federalist setup, different autonomous regions, which would shut out the Sunnis from any kind of oil revenue. The U.S. and Shiite leaders rushed to try and mollify some of those Sunni critics by saying, oh, no, this will be fixed after the constitution is passed when parliament comes back into session, and of course it hasn't been, and now those same Shiite leaders are talking about breaking up the country and probably have the votes to do it. We also had the handover this week, and I use that term very loosely, of the Iraqi military from the U.S. government to the Iraq government. That was delayed by several days. But even though it's happened, this is a farce. This is a PR thing, because the Iraqi military cannot stand on its own. Doesn't have any air power, doesn't have any tanks, doesn't have many of the things that you need to have a military, and therefore it needs the U.S. military for support. And if the U.S. military doesn't like something the Iraqi government wants to do in its deployment of the Iraqi military, the U.S. can just refuse to support it. So the U.S. still has effective control over anything that the Iraqi military does. And then last but not least, in Iraq this week, we had 2,974 global war on terror dead U.S. soldiers as of Monday in Iraq and Afghanistan. That surpasses the 2,973 that died in the World Trade Center. So Bush has now killed more Americans than Osama has, at least or than he did on 9/11. A very, very sad little milestone there.
All right, and quickly, Afghanistan.
Yeah, a lot of things going on in Afghanistan that I unfortunately don't have time to get to them all, but it's very telling that we're coming up on the fifth anniversary. The British NATO commander there says that the Taliban must be defeated in 6 months, as opposed to three or four, or they will have control of Afghanistan. Well-respected independent group in Europe called the Senlis Council, which I've quoted before, issued a report this week saying that Taliban now control about half of the country. That half is in something of a humanitarian crisis due to NATO and U.S. efforts to curtail poppy production, leaving people there without any real way to support themselves. Poppy production in the country as a whole, though, is way up. The Taliban are getting money from it and support also because they're combating U.S. efforts to eradicate. And the warlords that the U.S. and the Karzai government have put in power in other parts of the country, also very tied to poppy production. So opium production in Afghanistan, a record crop, up 50% this year. The Afghanistan itself can now supply 130% of the world's demand for heroin. So, you know, it's a good business to be in right now. And then on Thursday, a suicide bomb in Kabul, killing 16, including two U.S. soldiers. So once again, the violence there is escalating. The Taliban very much coming back into power.
And finally, Lebanon.
Yeah, Lebanon, the Israel has finally lifted its air and sea blockade of Lebanon. A report from Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, that IDF planes coming back from the U.S. with U.S. arms are now being refused landing rights in Britain, Germany, and Italy because of the violation of international law and human rights of Israel using those armaments in its attack on Lebanon.
All right. And events happening this week?
Several of them. A bunch of stuff going on this week, this weekend, rather. Highlights being the Art of Community Conference happening out in Kenmore today and tomorrow at Bastyr. Also, tonight, there is a fundraiser for civilian, essentially, civilian victims of Lebanon and the rebuilding that needs to go on there, being hosted by the Arab American Community Coalition. It will be at Town Hall at 6:30, $35 general seating, $70 reserved seating. September 15th, that is, what is that, next Friday? Yeah, next Friday. Okay. Karl Rove is going to be in town. He'll be at a fundraiser in Medina for a Dave Reichert. He's also doing something at an undisclosed East Side location to raise money for the state Republican Party. And then don't forget, a week from Tuesday, the primary election. ETH the State, of course, has its endorsements for those elections, which we talked about on this program last week. It's in its current current issue.
All right. Talking once again with Joe Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Well, that current issue with the election endorsements is available at places where you get free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, etc. You can also find it at the web, www.eatthestate.org. This week, on the 14th, is our 10th anniversary issue. We were actually founded, and this radio segment started 10 years ago this week. This is our anniversary, too, Mike. We've been doing it ever since. Yeah, I know. It's kind of sweet, isn't it? One of these days, I'm actually going to get to sleep in on Saturdays again. But in any event, so that's going to have all kinds of highlights from the past 10 years. I've been literally reading through every issue of Eat the State over the past couple of weeks, all 350 of them, to pull out. It's a lot of good stuff. So we'll have that this coming week. And then we're also starting our fall fundraising drive so we can actually print copies of Eat the State. that'll start this week also. So if you feel like donating, we'd very much appreciate it. You can do it by PayPal or at www.eatthestate.org, or send donations to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And of course, if you have, or if you missed any of that, or if you'd like to volunteer or have feedback, tips, anything like that, you can give our voicemail a call. The phone number for Eat the State voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.